John Rambo is going to war again. Rambo 4, starring Sylvester Stallone, is due out in 2006. I have not seen any of the movies, actually. It's not a genre I'm particularly interested in. But the name Rambo has come to symbolize a great deal, not just in our own culture here in America, but really around the world. It's the viewpoint that many people have of the American military. I'm sure that this one will continue the tradition of a war hero who accomplishes impossible feats of bravery in battle, blowing up anybody and everybody who gets in his way. Well, when I read the stories of Samson in Judges chapter 15, I think of Rambo. He is a Rambo-like figure who does impossible things in battle, and like Rambo, he single-handedly defeats all his enemies. Unlike Rambo, Samson accomplishes his feats in the power of God. God, you see, is judging the Philistines in chapter 15. And through Samson, he is trying to awaken the Israelites to the battle they should be fighting against the enemies of God in their culture. The tagline for Rambo 3 was, "God would have mercy, John Rambo won't." Well, the Bible clearly teaches that God does not always show mercy. He is a merciful and loving God, but He is also a just God who judges sin and judges cultures and nations when they turn against Him. The Philistines are God's enemy in the book of Judges, and God calls the Israelites to war in this book. We too are at war. But unlike the Israelites, our war is a spiritual war, not a physical one. As Christians, we are at war with sin in our world and in our own very lives. We are at war with sin. And God is calling us to fight this war in our day by His power. We face those who stand against God in our culture here in America today. For example, a member of the New Jersey Honor Guard was fired recently, a few years back, for saying, "God bless you and this family," to the members of a family at a New Jersey cemetery. Lost his job. A Minnesota state employee was banned from parking in the state parking lot because his car had stickers on it that read, "God is a loving and caring God." And the second sticker read, "God defines marriage as a union between a man and a woman." Not allowed to park in the state parking lot with those kinds of stickers on your car, in Minnesota anyway. God is trying to wake us up today, I think. The church in America today, like ancient Israel, is really filled with apathy, asleep. And God is trying to get our attention, just like He was trying to get the attention of the Israelites. If you travel to other parts of this world, you will often find the Church of Jesus Christ far more active and vigorous and vibrant than here in America, where we are often so passive. God's primary concern is the purity of the church, not the power of this world. And God, in the book of Judges, is primarily concerned with the heart of His people. And He is calling them to Himself. God rouses His own people to put Him first in their lives, just as He did in Samson's day. He wanted Israel to put Him first. So the first principle we learn in Judges 15 is part of God's tactic. Injustice incites vengeance, which provokes war. Ralph Waldo Emerson once wrote, people wish to be settled. Only as far as they are unsettled is there any hope for them. Well, God is trying to unsettle His people in Israel. And He is, I think, trying to unsettle His people in 21st century America. He is using the cycle here in Judges 15, the cycle of vengeance and violence that is so common to human behavior. He's using it to provoke His people into taking a stand against the Philistines. Because any enemy of God is an enemy of God's people. We cannot be friends with God and be friends with God's enemies too. Look at verses 1 through 3 of Judges 15 as we begin. But after a while, in the time of wheat harvest, it came about that Samson visited his wife with a young goat and said, I will go into my wife. It strikes me rather funny as I read that this morning. Visited his wife with a young goat. He had the young goat, not his wife. But her father did not let him enter, and her father said, I really thought that you hated her intensely, so I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister more beautiful than she? Please let her be yours instead. Samson then said to them, this time I shall be blameless in regard to the Philistines when I do them harm. All right, you remember the story from last week. Samson was from Zorah, and he met a Philistine woman in the town of Timnah, about 4 miles away. His parents paid all the fees, staged a wedding feast for Samson to marry this woman. But she betrayed Samson, and he never consummated the marriage with her at the close of Judges 14. Some time has now elapsed. He returns to visit her, hoping to complete his marriage to this Philistine woman. And he brings with him a young goat in lieu of a bouquet of flowers to make things right, I guess. Hoping to appease her. Actually, we know this was in keeping with the marriage practices of the day, as odd as it seems to us. There was a type of marriage known as a visitation marriage in the Middle East, where the woman would remain living at her home, and the husband would come and visit her periodically, and it was called a visitation marriage. And when the husband came, he was supposed to, as part of his husbandly duties, bring a gift for the family, usually a young goat or a sheep or something like that, as part of his husbandly duties. Well, Samson clearly assumed that he was married to this woman, so he intends to go into the bedroom with his wife, but the father informs him that he gave the woman in marriage to the best man at the wedding. You can read about it at the end of chapter 14. Here is a clear injustice. And even the Philistine father seems nervous about what he has done. He tells Samson that even we Philistines have moral standards, and you cannot have a sexual relationship with her because she's not your wife. She's married to this other man. And he offers Samson his younger daughter in marriage, since Samson has clearly paid the money, fulfilled all the legal requirements to marry his daughter. So he offers his younger daughter, and he suggests that she's more beautiful than her sister anyway. I'm not sure what her older sister thought of that assessment from Dad. But Samson is understandably angry. He storms out of the house after threatening the family. He seems to blame all the Philistines for this injustice. In fact, many, of course, had participated in the former plot against him. All right, verses 4 through 8. Samson went and caught 300 foxes and took torches, turned the foxes tail to tail, put one torch in the middle between two tails. When he had set fire to the torches, he released the foxes into the standing grain of the Philistines, thus burning up both the shocks and the standing grain, along with the vineyards and groves. Then the Philistines said, who did this? And they said, Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite. By the way, even the Philistines recognized that an injustice had been done here, because he took his wife and gave her to his companion. So the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire. And Samson said to them, since you act like this, I will surely take revenge on you. But after that, I'll quit. And he struck them ruthlessly with a great slaughter, and he went down and lived in the cleft of the rock of Etam. So it's harvest time in Israel. Samson comes up with an ingenious plan for revenge. He catches 300 jackals in the area. The Hebrew word translated fox can also be translated jackal. Foxes are solitary animals for the most part. Jackals travel in large packs. So most scholars believe that what he caught here were jackals, and probably caught several packs of jackals, trapped them, and went on with his plan. He ties their tails together. He puts a torch in each pair of tails, setting them loose to run through the fields. And the fields were set on fire. What a sight that must have been at harvest time. Can you imagine? Everywhere you look, fires are erupting and the jackals are yowling and yelling and the Philistines are screaming and there's a fire starting over here and it's over here and all over. The damage is extensive, that even the standing grain, vineyards, and olive groves catch fire in the confusion. You have to give Samson credit for being a creative juvenile delinquent here. And all this vandalism. Actually, I think the Israelites, as they told these stories of Samson, I think they got a good laugh out of many of these stories. They're almost written with that sort of juvenile joking kind of style to them, because I'm sure they were laughing. I suppose, though, that the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals didn't like his methods here. The Philistines react because revenge always provokes revenge in return. The cycle of vengeance is a never-ending cycle of violence. Samson may say, you know, I'm going to do this to you because you did that to me, but then I'm going to quit. In fact, he's not going to quit because he's going to be caught in this vicious cycle of vengeance. And it's never ending. Continues the process of provoking a war between the Israelites and the Philistines. Now, the stories are interesting, but what's God doing here? God is indeed trying to provoke a war between the Philistines and the Israelites, because the Israelites are too complacent in their lifestyle with the Philistines. Well, the Philistines don't come after Samson. Instead, they burn the father and his daughter to death for the injustice that they did to Samson. You remember from the story last week that they threatened to burn the mother and the daughter and father to death if she didn't betray Samson. So she betrayed Samson. Now they burn her to death anyway in the end. And Samson, now he's really angry. I mean, that was not what he expected to happen. He seems to be a decent sort of fellow. He didn't expect that they would burn his wife and her father and the home to the ground. So the text says that he sets out to kill Philistines as a result. He struck them ruthlessly with a great slaughter. The word ruthlessly means literally in the Hebrew, leg on thigh. Leg on thigh. It's an idiom. It apparently means that he killed the Philistines one by one in hand-to-hand combat, in wrestling matches, leg on thigh. Samson intends to stop after this little revenge, so he leaves the area to live in a cave. Of course, the cycle doesn't end here. Second principle, when God's people support God's enemies, they compromise God's cause. Verse 9. Then the Philistines went up and camped in Judah and spread out in Lehi. The men of Judah said, "Why have you come up against us?" And they said, "We have come up to bind Samson in order to do to him as he did to us." That's classic revenge, isn't it? In order to do to him what he did to us. That's the revenge cycle going on here. Of course, it won't end. It's still going on in the Middle East today. Then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock of Etam and said to Samson, "Do you not know that the Philistines are rulers over us? What then is this that you have done to us?" And he said to them, "As they did to me, so I have done to them." Revenge. And they said to him, "We have come down to bind you so that we may give you into the hands of the Philistines." Samson said to them, "Swear to me that you will not kill me." So they said to him, "No, but we will bind you fast and give you into their hands, yet surely we will not kill you." Well, deception going on here. I'm sure Samson, the Philistines were going to kill him, so they surely knew that they were handing him over to be killed, but they won't kill him. They'll keep their hands clean. Then they bound him with two new ropes and brought him up from the rock. All right, we need a little geography lesson about the nation of Israel for a few minutes. Just bear with me. Israel is divided in the north-south direction into three topographical regions. On the west, we start with the coastal plain. This is where the Philistines lived and controlled. They have their five city-states here in the coastal plain. The next piece or topographical section is the Shephelah, which is the lowlands, rolling hills, fertile valleys, very good agricultural area as well. Many of the Israelites lived in this area, but the Philistines still controlled the Shephelah. They still controlled the lowlands. Then you go to the hill country of Israel, where there are small mountains, sharp ravines, fairly rugged country. Jerusalem, for example, is located in the hill country. That's why when you read in the scriptures and it says they went up to Jerusalem, it always refers to going up to Jerusalem. It's because literally you go up to Jerusalem. It's up in the hill country of Israel. The tribes of Judah and Simeon occupied the central area in the south of Israel. The region of Judah is divided into six valleys that follow rivers in an east-west direction from the hill country to the Mediterranean Sea. Samson lived in the second valley from the north, the Sorek Valley. Each of these valleys also controlled the major highways from the coast to the cities in the central hill country. The only reason why I tell you all of that is to give you some idea of what is happening here geographically as we think through the Samson story. We do not actually know where these places were located, but we can make some guesses. For example, we do not know where Lehi is located. The name simply means jawbone. Probably was named Jawbone or nicknamed Jawbone because of what Samson does, as we will read in a few verses. We also do not know where the rock of Etam is located, but we do know it is in the territory of Judah, because it is Judah that is threatened by the Philistines. Now we are told that Samson went down to the rock of Etam and lived in a cave. That's a significant phrase, went down. The term went down would probably not refer in Hebrew culture to going into the central hill country, because you would be going, that would be referred to going up. There are many caves in the mountains of the hill country. But Samson probably did not go up to those caves. He went down, which means he stayed in the Shephelah, the lowlands, and probably went south to this cave. Two valleys south of the Sorek Valley is the Guvran Valley. This valley opens into a plain where the Philistine city of Gath was built and controlled that whole valley, so it would at least be plausible to locate the events of this chapter in the Guvran Valley. Perhaps somewhere in this valley is the place called Jawbone, where Samson defeated the Philistines. This slide is looking east from the Philistine city of Gath in the direction of the Guvran Valley. In the Guvran Valley are some very famous caves called the Bell Caves. These are not high on the mountain, but open deep down into the earth through small crevices, would make a possible location for Samson, since we're told that when they bind him, they take him up out of the caves to the Philistines. The Philistines arrived to fight the tribe of Judah that lived in this area. Samson perhaps was in one of these caves. We don't know. The crevices that opened in the caves, for example, you can see the light from one of them up above here, are small, and it would have been a protected hiding place. As the Philistines arrive with their armies, the Israelites are afraid. What's going to happen to us? The men of Judah become alarmed, and rather than taking on the Philistines, rather than going to war with the Philistines, what do? They turn on God's judge. They go after Samson. They send 3,000 men to take this one man. Why 3,000? Seems like a little bit of overkill. Well, apparently they intended to take him by force if necessary, because Samson has become a problem for God's people. Here's God's judge who has become a problem for God's people. And they're going to side with God's enemies, the Philistines, and turn Samson over to the Philistines. The men of Judah start negotiating with Samson. It becomes clear that Samson does not want to fight his own countrymen. He is, by the way, a genuine hero to the Israelites. He is listed in God's hall of faith in Hebrews chapter 11. He does not want to hurt his own people. He has no quarrel with his own people. He may well have moved to these caves to avoid bringing any more problems to his people and to his family. In fact, all the way through this account, Samson seems to be the sort of a reluctant warrior, sort of thrown into these things. So he says to the Israelites, the men of Judah, he says, "Well, promise me that you won't kill me, and I will let you take me peaceably." What's he concerned with? Well, he's not concerned with the Philistines. What he's concerned with is that the men of Judah will come at him forcibly, and he'll have to fight them, and he doesn't want to fight his own people. So they promise they won't kill him. They bind him with new ropes. They bring him up from the cave to the Philistines. Now, God was trying to awaken his people, the Israelites, to the fact that the Philistines were God's enemies. And he's using Samson to lead the Israelites. And he sets it all up. And what do the Israelites do? Back off and side with the Philistines. They're so fearful of the enemy that they turn Samson over to the Philistines. They don't rally behind Samson and stand with God. They're ready to watch Samson die before their eyes so they can live comfortably. They long ago made peace with the enemies of God. They do not want to rock the boat in their culture. They're comfortable. Application. There's a lesson, an important lesson for the church in America today in this story. I think we too have largely made our peace with our culture. We are comfortable, we're complacent, we've compromised out of fear, and we've lost our first love for God and our love for the things of this world. Is that a fair assessment of the church as a whole in America today? I'm not pointing the finger at any individual here, I'm just talking about the church as a whole. I think it is a fair assessment of us. When God's people support God's enemies, they compromise God's cause, and God's cause is constantly being compromised today when we're unwilling to stand for God's values. God forces us to make a choice. God will not let His people stay on the fence for long. We are either with God or against God, but there's no in between. God is either number one or we're fighting God. Sometimes God makes the choice black and white. Now, it's important to be careful at this point, I think, because we are prone to think that the problem is out there in our culture. It's the world's problem. Look how bad they are. Look at our society. Look at what they're doing. But I want you to notice that God is really less concerned, really, with the Philistines and more concerned with His own people. God can take care of the Philistines of this world in any age, in any generation. He's not worried about the Philistines of this world. God's trying to get a hold of His people. He wants His people to turn back to Him, heart and soul and mind and body. He's trying to rouse us to follow Him with our whole hearts. The real issue is not out there in the world. It's in here, in the church. Ravi Zacharias, in his book Deliver Us From Evil, cites a Canadian historian named David Marshall for his analysis of our situation here in America. We need a Canadian historian to tell us what's wrong with the church in America. David Marshall explains why the social climate in Canada has become so anti-Christian, and he argues that the same process is happening in America. and we can learn from what they have learned. He lays most of the blame not on the social forces out there, but on the church, and particularly on church leaders, and specifically on pastors. Ouch. He says that pastors are largely to blame for this slide into secularism in our world. Why? Because he says it was among the pastors and the theologians and the church leaders that the defection and compromise began that led to the church's current loss of vision for what God calls us to be in this world. The problem is with churches and church leaders. Now, I think he's got a point, as painful as that point is. I'll cite just one example in support of his thesis from here in New England. Just a few years ago, the Episcopal Church in New Hampshire voted to approve the appointment of Gene Robinson as Bishop of New Hampshire. You may have read many articles about that. Gene Robinson was an openly gay man, and his appointment spoke volumes to our culture at large. The church is saying that this is acceptable behavior. That was the message our culture got from that appointment of Bishop Robinson. Loud and clear, the church was saying this is okay. And largely, the world doesn't distinguish real carefully between pieces of Christianity. They just see things as a whole. Peter James Lee, one of the 60 bishops who voted for his appointment, said these really remarkable words. Listen carefully. He said, "If you must make a choice between heresy and schism, always choose heresy." That's what the bishop said. If you have to make a choice between going against what the Bible says, supporting heresy, or having a disagreement or a split with somebody who disagrees with you, always choose heresy. That's what the church is saying. Wait a minute. When God's people support God's enemies, they compromise God's cause, and the message is loud and clear in our culture today. So on any one of these social issues, people can cite all kinds of church leaders in support of heresy, of sin, and feel validated. The church is compromising today. It is showing in our culture. We are caving into the pressures of the Philistines around us, and God is not pleased. We need to stand up to our culture. We need to creatively live out God's values, not fearing the enemy, for God's on our side. The church is a powerful weapon in God's hands for good in any society, and God is calling the church to follow Him. Now, we don't have to take up swords and spears to fight the enemy. This is a spiritual battle. It's not a physical battle. We're not ancient Israel. And we don't just fight in the political showdowns of the day. Politics is one element of this. And there are groups and individuals that are very active in the political end of this whole battle culturally. And that's fine. There's a place for that. But I'm not suggesting to you that the answer is politics, making laws. That's not the spiritual warfare answer to the problems of our culture, ultimately. Because you make all the laws in the world you want. If hearts aren't changed, it doesn't matter. God's business is first and foremost spiritual warfare. And we fight this battle really in the trenches, because it is in the trenches of people's lives where this battle is won and lost day by day, in the situations and opportunities and places where compromise and choices are being played out every day. There are so many ways to be involved in this battle. And in fact, many in our church and in other churches are indeed involved in many ways in this battle spiritually in our culture. We have people who are fighting abortion. Abortion is wrong. We have people who are fighting abortion through the ministry of Abba, for example, a powerful ministry which gives hope and encouragement to unwed mothers, one mother at a time, changing lives. What a powerful way to be involved in this spiritual battle. We have people fighting the battle of poverty through ministries like the Root Cellar, or helping children grow into productive Christian adults through foster homes and adoption. Powerful ways to be involved in influencing our society for God. Christian teachers in public schools living out their faith in productive and constructive ways. Powerful. Others are fighting this battle by working in our prisons and helping shattered men and women turn their lives around by Christ's power. Our CEF missionary, Beth Wilson, is carrying on a remarkable ministry among the immigrants as God brings the world to Portland, Maine. It's tremendous, the opportunities that exist to be involved in this battle, one by one by one, as God changes hearts and lives. When God changes the hearts and minds of a culture, He changes a culture. Those are examples. You can think of many more. Spiritual warfare. Where are we involving ourselves in the battles of our culture? Where are we living out God's values in this world? Third principle. How are you going to win this battle? Because we're brilliant? Because we have more political clout than other people? Because we can make better laws? Because we're smarter? No. Victory comes by our dependence on God's power. That's the only way. It's the only way. Verses 14 through 20. When he came, Samson came to Lehi, the Philistines shouted as they met him. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, so that the ropes that were on his arms were as flax that is burned with fire, and his bonds dropped from his hands. And he found a fresh jawbone of a donkey, so he reached out and took it, and he killed 1,000 men with it. Then Samson said, "With the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, I've killed 1,000 men." And it came about when he had finished speaking that he threw the jawbone from his hand, and he named that place Ramath Lehi. Then he became very thirsty, and he called to the Lord and said, "Thou hast given this great deliverance by the hand of thy servant, and now shall I die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised? You helped me fight this whole battle. You're not going to provide me any water?" But God split the hollow place that is in Lehi so that water came out of it. When he drank, his strength returned and he revived. Therefore he named it En-Hachori, which is in Lehi to this day. So he judged Israel 20 years in the days of the Philistines. Ramath Lehi means Jawbone Hill in the Hebrew. So this is the Battle of Jawbone Hill. Samson grabs a jawbone of the donkey lying somewhere on the ground. He uses this simple weapon to win a great battle for God. The Hebrew notes that this is a fresh jawbone, meaning that it's not old and brittle. Archaeologists actually have discovered in Israel a jawbone of a donkey that had been turned into a weapon by implanting iron teeth where the teeth go, and it had been made a serious weapon in ancient Israel. Well, he didn't have time to do all that. He just grabbed a fresh jawbone that was somewhat pliable, and he began to go to war with that little weapon. He didn't need iron swords. He didn't need spears. The Philistines had all that weaponry, and he kills 1,000 men in battle. And I read all the commentators and those who don't take the historical accuracy of this book, who don't view it very highly, all say, he kills 1,000 men in open battle, that's impossible. Yeah, it was. Absolutely impossible. Because it's a miracle. God did it through Samson. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him so that he became invincible. That's the only way this story could make sense. It is an absolutely impossible feat apart from God doing it. Never, ever count God out of your battles, your situations, your struggles. We don't need the weapons of this world. In fact, far too often we rely on the weapons of this world to win the battles. It's a spiritual battle. It's God's battle. We need God. That's what we need. We need to awaken in a fresh way to God's power at work in our lives and through us in this world. God turned the entire Roman world in the first century upside down for Christ through 12 fishermen. What can He do through the Church of Jesus Christ in America today? It's God's battle. What He's looking for is people who wake up and say, I'll be a part of it. The sad reality is that 3,000 Israelites, what did they do? They bound Samson, they bring him to the Philistines, and then they stand on a hill somewhere and they watch Samson fight the Philistine army by himself. Oh, great warriors these guys are. They stand and watch. I wonder if any of them thought as Samson actually began to win this battle and the Philistines began to run away from Samson in his fight, I wonder if anybody thought, hey, you know, maybe with all of our armor, we're all ready for war. We came thinking we had to fight Samson. Maybe we ought to step into this thing. But instead, they stand there on the sidelines. They go, yes, very good. Yeah, yeah, rah, rah. That's what they did. The church today often becomes spectators, watching a few chosen warriors get involved and fight for God. We stand to the sides. Good job out there. Good job. Perhaps that's why Samson was so discouraged after the battle. He'd fought hard without any help. He was thirsty. He cries out to God for help. By the way, this is the first time in the entire account that we read that Samson cried out to God. Up until now, the Spirit of the Lord's come upon him. He's done some great things, but he doesn't cry out for God. He doesn't seem to sense his dependence upon God. And I suspect that that is probably why God made him so thirsty or allowed him to become so thirsty. It's time for you, Samson, to realize where your power comes from. You depend on me too. And he cries out to God. A later prophet of God, Elijah, will cry out to God after one of his great victories in a similar way. I'm thirsty, I'm hungry, and you've given me up, God. He's discouraged. He's hurting. God hears his cry, intervenes, and splits a hollow place. The word literally means a mortar, like the common bowl pictured here that the Israelites used for grinding grain so that water flowed to meet Samson's needs. So apparently it was a place there in Israel that looked something like a mortar out of which water came. Samson quenched his thirst and he revived. He named the place literally, well, he named it En Hakor. In the Hebrew, that means the caller's spring. The caller's spring. When you call upon God, He refreshes you. He meets your need in the battle. That's the caller's spring. God will refresh you too when you come to the caller's spring. Have you come to the caller's spring? If you're Israel, you don't need the caller's spring because you're pretty comfortable where you are. If you're fighting like Samson, you need to come to the caller's spring for refreshment. If you're in the battle, you need God's refreshing, thirst-quenching spirit filling your lives. God promises that if He calls us to do something for Him, He will provide whatever we need to do it. That's God's promise to us. He doesn't promise it'll be easy. He just promises that He'll provide what we need if He calls us to do it. Call on Him. We must come to God first before we can fight the spiritual battles of this world. And we are at war today. And our young people are facing the fight we've failed to win. I told the row of young people this morning, they're sitting right here so I can talk to them, see? But our young people are facing battles today because we have failed in many cases to effectively influence our culture. And in many cases, our young people are standing stronger than we ever stood in the battle. A Houston teacher trashed two students' Bibles, took them to the principal's office, and threatened to report the parents to Child Protective Services for allowing the students to bring their Bibles to school. Houston, Texas. I applaud the students who took their Bibles. I'd say, as parents, take them back again. A ninth grader got a 0 on a research project because she chose Jesus as the subject, and the teacher refused to let her write a substitute paper as makeup. 0. A student in St. Louis was caught praying over lunch. Caught praying over lunch. Isn't that awful? The teacher lifted him from his seat, reprimanded him in front of his classmates, and ordered him to never pray in school again. All right, young people, just think. Prayer over lunch can be a subversive activity. You can be rebellious for God in school, and we'll all shout hallelujah for you. How's that? Your chance to be rebellious for God. God calls us to follow Him in His fight with sin. The greatest power in the fight is our purity for God. Peter Kreft, in his book, How to Win the Culture War, writes these powerful words. The strongest weapon in the world is sanctity. Nothing can defeat it. Saints are not nice, he says. There's a novel idea. They are embroiled in controversy necessarily always. This is because saints are as devoted to truth as they are to love. They will not be false prophets who give the people what they want instead of what they need. But no matter how unpopular the job description of the saint may be, their double devotion to truth and love is the only weapon that can win the war against our culture of death. Here's the words. Only saints can save the world. The deepest reason why the church is weak and the world is dying is that there are not enough saints. No, that is not quite honest, he says. The reason is that we are not acting like the saints we are. Saints are people set apart for God, people whom God controls. They are God's answer to the sin of this world. At the 1995 mayoral prayer breakfast in Washington, D.C., 10-year-old Ashley Oubre delivered a speech that got 2 standing ovations. 10 years old, this young lady. She addressed Mayor Barry and the other adults respectfully, and then quoted the verse about the need to become like a little child to enter God's kingdom. And then she ended her speech with these powerful words that I think apply to our whole society, coming from a 10-year-old young lady. She said, "I think you adults tell us Bible stories because we're children. The Bible stories do us a lot of good, but you don't tell each other Bible stories. Are they only good for children?" You teach us that when we have a problem, we should talk it out in others and with Jesus. You say that we should pray about it and keep our hearts right for Jesus. You say that Jesus can solve all our problems, both big and small. But we notice when people get older and have problems, they are embarrassed to talk like that among themselves. We wonder if you really mean it, or is Jesus only for kids? I'm still young enough to believe that Jesus knows how to solve my problems, the problems of this city and of the world. I hope I never grow old enough to stop believing, and that you all become like children in search of God's kingdom. Thank you very much for listening to me. God bless you all. Would to God there were more Ashleys in this world. What a powerful statement of God's values in a respectful and uncompromising manner. Father, teach us. Teach us like you are showing us through young people like Ashley and others. Teach us to have the courage to live for you, even when those don't like what we stand for. Be glorified in our lives, as you will one day totally be in this world, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.